Soweto, Sudafrika. We sing the song of solidarity. We're freedom fighting, defenders of dignity, who use the truth as a shield. There is no bullet that can kill the truth when you defend it with reason. So let's join together to end this evil madness that we all call racism, both here and there.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Street Heat. This is our monthly celebration of the struggle for workers' rights and social justice. I'm your host, Pam Whalen. Mike Rhodes is on the controls. You're listening to KFCF Fresno, 88.1. And we're going to be talking today about a number of things that are going on in the law enforcement community and the general community here, how that's the community here has been impacted by law enforcement. We're going to talk about the situation in the Fresno County Public Defender's Office, which many folks who have had to go through the criminal justice system have had the experience of how hard it is to get adequate representation going through a criminal justice process. We're also going to be talking to Brian Sumner, who was convicted this week of vandalism for chalking the police memorial in Fresno. And we're going to be talking to him about what that was like and what his take is on where things are right now. And we're also going to be talking to Luis Ojeda, who is with the California Immigrant Youth Project. And he's been organizing protests against the cooperation between Sheriff Margaret Mims and the Immigration Service. So we're going to be covering all those issues today, but we're going to turn now to the attorney from the American Civil Liberties Union, Novella Coleman. Novella, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Novella, we we've read in the paper, we've seen that the ACLU has sued the County of Fresno and also the state because of inadequate representation for indigent defense clients here in Fresno County. Can you kind of explain generally what that what caused the ACLU to file that lawsuit?
Yes. So Fresno County's public defense system has had problems for years, and those issues have not been addressed by the Fresno County Board of Supervisors or by the state of California. So even going back to 2010, the head of the Public Defender's Office warned the Board of Supervisors that the staffing cuts they were making was limiting the office's ability to satisfy its constitutional mandate to provide adequate representation to folks. And those concerns went ignored, and at one point the public defender actually had to decline cases because they just could not physically cover the courtroom. And so those problems continued and exist to the present day, where the county and the state are simply failing to provide enough resources to ensure that people who are accused of a crime can adequately represent and be represented and exercise their right to a lawyer without depending on their ability to pay for one or hire one on their own.
Yeah, so there's just generally a lack of resources, and that affects staffing, so that affects how many lawyers there are in the public defender's office. That also affects how many investigators they have, and really, ultimately, it affects their ability to satisfy the minimum requirements of the Constitution. So what you have in Fresno County is that felony attorneys are averaging around 612 cases, when under national standards they should have no more than 150. And misdemeanor attorneys are having on average around 1,400 cases, whereas under national standards they should have no more than 400 cases in a year. And so that means that they just don't have enough hours in the day to do all of the things that is required during the course of a criminal defense. And so that means for their clients, they aren't able to receive the type of representation they need because the county and the state have simply refused to adequately staff the office and ensure that the legal representation that is provided satisfies the minimal standards of the law.
Okay, and we're talking to Novello Coleman, who is an attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union, who has filed a suit against the County of Fresno. So tell us a little bit about, you know, you've talked about the situation. How does it feel? Kind of what's the experience for someone who, you know, is in the criminal justice system, has a felony or misdemeanor? How does this lack of resources affect them?
Yeah, so it affects them all throughout the process. Initially, when the public defender is appointed to represent them, many people may meet their public defender on one day and talk to them for a few minutes and then be advised or be in a situation where they have to plead out to those charges on the same day, and all of that can happen without having an adequate factual investigation. And so people accused of a crime may end up pleading guilty to crimes they actually did not commit simply because there aren't enough resources to go into the defense process. And then when you talk about people who are charged with more serious crimes, they may be placed in jail while their case is being resolved. And so the same people who can't afford a lawyer are the same people who can't afford to make bail. And so while they're sitting in jail, the rest of their life is going on without them. That impacts their family. That may result in the loss of a job. All kinds of things result as a from their absence in their community. And so it really does have a large effect on whether or not someone might decide to plead guilty, because if you're sitting in jail for so long that you actually serve the sentence, then you might feel pressured to plead guilty simply so you can be released. However, the felony conviction that you then have, that's going to stay on your record for the rest of your life. And if you're on parole, then that's going to affect your ability to vote. If you're even just having the conviction itself might affect your ability to apply for certain housing or jobs. And so it really does have lifelong consequences.
Okay. And, you know, talk a little bit about, you know, who are actually the people in the Fresno community and in Fresno County that that wind up, you know, having to deal with this situation? Who is the clients for this, for the public defender's office?
Just taking a step back, in the state of California, more than 8 out of 10 people accused of a crime rely on court-appointed counsel. So I think a lot of times people think about the right to a lawyer and the indigent person's right to a lawyer as a right that a poor person has. But really, it's not just poor people who are affected. There are lots of middle-income people, working-class people who simply can't afford to pay for their own attorneys. So it affects people from all but the wealthiest of financial classes. And then when you look at just the demographics of who's accused of a crime, in Fresno County, you have a higher arrest rate for people of color, and so they're going to make up disproportionately the people who are represented by the public defender and other appointed counsel. So the discriminatory policing practices that may be happening in Fresno County are then going to be duplicated in who needs the public defender. And so the racial injustice that exists throughout the criminal justice system is further exacerbated because it's those people who can't afford to pay for their own attorney as well.
Okay. And also, I mean, we've heard over the years about, you know, the situation with the Fresno County Jail being overcrowded, you know, having to let, you know, we've heard stories, they have to let people go because they, you know, because they simply, you know, they're under court order, so they have to let people go. What's the interplay between what's happening in the public defender's office and in the jail?
So there are around 70% of the people who are in Fresno County Jail are what we call pretrial detainees, so they haven't yet been convicted of a crime, and they're awaiting a determination by a court about whether or not they're guilty or innocent. So given the high caseloads in the public defender's office, that's going to create a backlog because they just don't have the time to get to those cases right away. So in Fresno County, you have a lot of cases being continued for reasons that aren't in the client's interest, but simply because the public defender's office is understaffed. And that's something that that Fresno County is causing that problem by understaffing the public defender's office. But then there having to pay for that choice on the other end by keeping all of these people in the jail who haven't even been convicted of a crime.
So it's impacting everybody, really.
Yeah, and it has an impact on the budget of the county throughout the system. It there's going to be more money spent on law enforcement, on the sheriff, on detaining people when that money could be saved up front by simply providing people with adequate representation. And it also means that in Fresno County, where you have people pleading guilty to crimes that they did not commit, that means you have people presumably who did commit that crime who are not going to be prosecuted simply because the system isn't able to accurately identify who, in fact, committed the crime.
Okay. So you also sued the state of California. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Yeah, so in the state of California, the public defense system is primarily operated by each of the 58 counties. So that means the state has, in effect, delegated its constitutional duty to the counties without providing any oversight and without providing any funding. So depending on which county you're in, that's going to affect what the county's general fund is, which is going to affect what the budget is for the public defense system. So even a statewide commission a few years back found that there isn't any consistency in the level of representation that people are being provided across the counties across the state in the different counties, and the state hasn't done anything to address that. So that's how you can see in counties like Fresno, where there's less of money available, the public defender's office simply isn't going to get what it needs, even to satisfy the minimal requirements of the Constitution. And then when you look to the Constitution itself, it's the 6th and 14th Amendments that ultimately make the state responsible for providing that legal representation to people who can't afford to pay for it on their own.
Okay, and we're talking to Novella Coleman, who is an attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union. And so the lawsuit has been filed. So what's going to happen now?
So right now we're waiting for the defendants to reply to the lawsuit. So they will have to reply by August 14th. And then depending on that, going from there, it depends on what their response is. Just to give an example, by looking at other states, in the state of Washington, a similar lawsuit was filed, and it took about 3 years for the case to be resolved, and it actually went to trial. And in the state of New York, it took about 6 years, and the resolution was a settlement on the eve of trial. And in both of those cases, the result was that the defendant, the cities, and then the state as well, were required to change their system so that it accorded people accused of a crime with the minimal legal representation required by the Constitution. So it really does, when the counties and states don't respond to the complaint that has been presented to them, it ends up taking a long time and a lot of resources to make an accurate determination. And that's unfortunate here, where we've tried to work with Fresno County to fix these problems without bringing a lawsuit, and where even folks from within the public defender's office have pointed out this problem and the county has simply ignored them.
So, I mean, no, you don't have a crystal ball, but I mean, is there any prospect that we can get this resolved, you know, without waiting years?
So we've been in discussions with Fresno County for a while now. Even back in December of 2014, we sent the county a Public Records Act request, and we've had meetings with them and even had meetings with the county administrative officer before that. And so we hope that those conversations about how to resolve this problem and how to fix the system will continue, even though the lawsuit has been filed.
Okay. I mean, and when you talked to them, what was their take on it?
Unfortunately, their take was that there was no problem. And at one point they said that the staffing levels that they have had always been sufficient. And at one point they said, well, we're doing the best we can with the amount of money we have. But really the county's duty to comply with the Constitution isn't dependent on how much money the county has. So satisfying the requirements of the Sixth Amendment, the right to counsel and the due process clause aren't contingent on the county's budget.
Okay, so how can, I mean, I don't know if there's anything that folks can do, people, you know, maybe you've had experience with the public defender's office or just concerned people in the community, activists, which some of we have right here waiting to speak next, which are, really concerned about criminal justice reform. Is there anything people can do or any way they can reach you?
So, before even the lawsuit was filed, we had community organizations and even national right to counsel organizations writing letters to the Board of Supervisors in Fresno County expressing their concerns about the system. And so that's something that folks can continue to do. And the ACLU does have a civil rights and civil liberties hotline. For this particular matter, we are not encouraging people who have an open and ongoing criminal case to contact us because we want to respect the attorney-client privilege that they have. But for folks who have already been through the system, if they're willing to share information with us, then that's an option that's available to them.
And how can they reach you?
So the ACLU has a website, and that's www.aclunc.org, and that will provide all of the information with how to contact us here at the ACLU.
Okay. Novella Coleman from the American Civil Liberties Union. Is there anything you'd like to add?
I think ultimately, really, this lawsuit is about everyone having equal access and an equal right to defend themselves and to exercise their rights. And we continue to say that your right to a lawyer should not depend on how much money you have in the bank. And we look forward to finding a way to resolve this problem in Fresno County.
Okay. Thank you very much, Novella.
And
we're going to take a brief musical break, but don't change the dial because we're going to be talking with Brian Sumner, who has been much in the headlines this last week, being convicted for vandalism for chalking the City of Fresno Police Memorial. And we're going to be talking to Brian, so we'll be right back. This is KFCF Fresno, 88.1. You're listening to the Street Heat Show, the monthly celebration of the struggle for workers' rights and social justice. I'm your host, Pam Whalen. And joining us in the studio, we have Brian Sumner and Dylan Donnelly. Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Great. Well, Brian, it's been a whirlwind week for you. We've been reading about what's going on with your trial. And I know you are a veteran and have been very active in the police accountability movement. Tell us what's been going on, your take on it, and why how did your experience as, you know, in the armed service influence your interest in police accountability?
Well, I kind of correlated it to military operations in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Very policing.
Mm-hmm.
Very overbearing. Very violent.
Mm-hmm.
And that just didn't agree with me. Like, that's not what my perspective of a peace officer was supposed to be. And just kind of organically on my own, like, search for freedom, my own search for the like the definitions of these words, like freedom and liberty, and how do we apply them universally. I stumbled upon people who were doing cop block. And
so what is cop block?
Cop block is the really large, maybe even the world's largest, police accountability organization. And basically cop block is using a video camera to create objective records of police interactions, so that there's no opportunity for the officers to lie or to misstate any of the facts.
It seems like, I don't know, on my Facebook these days, it seems like there is a very qualitative difference in terms of how many of these interactions are being caught on video and shared with the public.
You mean there's more now?
Yeah.
Well, that means that people are doing a good job of spreading the message of police accountability.
Right.
And the police are doing it kind of for themselves, you know. The more violent they are, the more people recognize the need.
Right. Okay, so talk a little bit about your trial. Particularly interested, I guess, because we were just talking about the public defender's office and some of the lack of resources there, and I know you did have a public defender, so just kind of talk about your trial. What was it like, and just walk us through it.
Let me think about this question for a minute, and we'll come back to it. How about that?
About what?
We'll come back to this question. I gotta think about it for
you
a second.
You gotta think about it. Yeah. Okay. Well, why don't you talk about a little bit about what have been your activities in police in the police accountability movement? What have you been doing?
Well, I started out as like a very lonely one man revolution, and I was just out filming the police with my cell phone, and I met some other people, you know, around town who were doing it. And me and Dylan then started a website, you know, dedicated around, or I guess Dylan started it and I just produced content for it. But I say like we started it,
mm-hmm,
kind
mm-hmm.
of generally.
Teamwork.
Yeah, teamwork, exactly.
So what exactly do you have you, well, and Dylan, what exactly have you guys been able to do with this, with the website?
Well, I think we've been able to build a platform that challenges mainstream narrative, especially when it comes to police, after issues with police shootings, etc. And people are recognizing it, and they're contacting us about their experiences with police. And it provides them an outlet, because these aren't always stories that, you know, Fox or whoever wants to talk about.
So tell us about some of the stories.
Well, one was... you know, one of the early ones was a woman who the police were responding to some gunshots. They came into the neighborhood and profiled the teenage son who had nothing to do with the shooting, and ended up actually searching this house and let the dog out and shot the dog.
Wow.
And that's something you never really heard about.
Uh-huh.
Stuff like that.
Yeah. And what, do you know what part of, what neighborhood this was in?
I would have to go back.
You'd have to go back. Okay.
Read, yeah.
Okay. Okay, so there's a chance for them to tell their story.
Yeah, you know, we try to contact the police department, too. And it's like a wall, you know. They just pretend like we don't exist. They don't respond to information requests. They don't give an opportunity to tell their story, you know.
I've personally, like, gone down to the police department and asked to speak to the POI officers. And they always just tell me, he's busy, you know, he's for the foreseeable future. And this is, like, multiple attempts. I was trying to get information on the body cameras in February, and also when they launched Beware. I went multiple times for both of those, and I was just told he'd be busy for hours.
Let's talk about surveillance a bit. Tell us about this. What is, I mean, I know there was stuff in the Fresno Bee about it, but what is this Beware, you know, and should we be concerned about it?
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
So what does it do?
Beware was actually covered on the front page of the Community Alliance a couple months ago. And basically, it's a program that is an app that officers have access to. It's ran by a company called Intrado. And it works very much like credit score and credit checks. They compile information from your purchases, from your social media sites, from your Google searches. They compile your internet history, your phone records, your criminal history, your DMV, anything they can get their hands on that's commercial information, and they compile it into a dossier or a database, and it assigns you a criminal threat rating. And then the officer is supposed to be able to make better decisions based on this threat rating that you receive. But in reality, what it does is preemptively give this officer a reason to either treat you like his friend or treat you like his enemy without ever meeting you. And so you could have a green threat rating and be having a bad day and kill this officer. And you could be having a red threat rating and having a great day and be killed by the officer. And it's very prejudicial, and there's no mention on whether race is taken into it, and I imagine that would just be too controversial of a topic to be public on.
All right, and I don't know, Dylan, do you want to talk about this?
Sure, I'll touch on it. You know, I think the most concerning part of Beware is that they're using your speech against you to label you a threat.
Mm-hmm.
And as somebody who criticizes police probably all day, every day on social media, that concerns me. Well, you know, they see my license plate and, you know, a red shows up that says I'm a threat. It's outrageous to me.
So it's very much a potentially a chilling effect on speech.
Yeah, right? Now I have cops approaching me like I'm a threat to them, and I don't even have a violent criminal history.
Right. You know? So have you guys had... I mean, I other kinds of retaliatory felt that the police have retaliated against you for being active.
There's been instances where I've been harassed by the police just for being a cop blocker, you know, for filming them. And then there's been instances on social media where cops from like all the way across the nation will call me a scumbag and give me these big rants, you know. But other than wasting $10,000 on a kangaroo court to prosecute me for my speech, no.
That's kind of a big one, right?
Yeah. It's like the prosecutor had no problem with the chalk on the ground.
Uh-huh.
You know, because that's speech.
Uh-huh.
So then what is chalk on this granite rock? No longer speech. You know? What it does my speech change if I walk into a house? Is that no longer free speech? Does my speech change when I, you know, free speech is free speech, and if you have to pay for it, it's no longer free speech.
Okay. So tell me about this cop block. Are a lot of people engaged in this in Fresno, and how can people kind of like get, you know, find out about it and get involved with it?
In Fresno, I'd say that there's a relatively small number of us. And that's not to say that there aren't people filming the police that I'm not in contact with, because I have seen that. But to my like actual knowledge, I believe the number is relatively small.
And how can people get more involved with it? Or, I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of people who would be like, I don't know if I want to do this, right? I mean, I don't know if I'm going to get in trouble.
Well, you
know?
Don't have to cop block to support people who cop block.
Okay.
You can contribute by writing articles that are that you think that you could write a counter narrative to, you know, like we do. You could be on the streets filming the police. You could even donate financially to support people who you feel are doing a good job and need extra funds for cameras or, you know, gear. Because one of the things I'm really passionate about is putting cameras in other people's hands. And Dylan and I have talked about this, about in some way being able to raise money to provide a few cameras, you know, to people who've shown an interest in being a dedicated cop watcher, somebody out there collecting, you know, evidence on what the police are doing, holding them accountable.
Okay, and can people reach you? How do people get a hold of you, Dylan?
Well, they could reach us at FresnoPeoplesMedia.com, and there's also the Facebook page, Cop Block Fresno, and that's actually a website too, CopBlockFresno.org. And they're related, so you know, the messages go to the same people. And Brian has his Facebook page, Fresno Liberty Movement, so they could reach him there if they message him. And we're kind of easy to find if you look for us.
Okay, and I want to kind of ask you maybe a little bit more philosophical question. What ideas or, analysis, what are things that you think about that could really be effective in resolving the issues around, you know, you're talking about the seeing the police here acting in a very military manner as an occupying army. How can that be resolved? How can that be changed? Either one of you.
I think a lot of it comes with the people's understanding that the cops aren't there to protect you. And everybody you've seen laying in the street dead is a cop failing to do their job if they claim to protect us, right? All they do is show up and take a report and clean the body up. So why don't we start by stop calling the cops? Stop involving the police. Because it only leads to more violence. And also, it's just, there's also a lot of alternatives to ending the police, you know? And some of them are through things that people may not agree with or whatever, but I think if we privatized it a little bit and made a competitive marketplace for some sort of effective law enforcement, and if we cut back on the amount of laws...
It has been privatized to a certain extent.
Well, it's a monopoly.
But it's also like there's... I'm going to kind of speak, you know, the other side of this, because particularly in the immigration field, a lot of the incarceration has been privatized, and not to very good, really, results at this point. It creates a huge profit motive, right, for people to be incarcerated. I mean, it does that also, I mean, I think in the public sector, because people want to protect their jobs, but I think we've seen... And Louise will be here talking about the immigration situation.
It's interesting because all these jails that immigrants are getting thrown into are being built by immigrants. You know, it's the interesting thing about
right,
it.
Right.
You know?
But there also been there's a huge lobby that they have to have so many immigrants in jails every night, so that these people can continue to make their profits. Which is kind of a scary thing when you think about it.
Well, if we had less laws. You know, if we really focused on laws that were actually beneficial to society instead of laws that were just prohibitive to our behavior, then we wouldn't have to worry about such large military police forces. Because what do you see the military cops doing? They're breaking into people's houses in the middle of the night over plants that they don't agree with, over people who are, you know, they own guns they don't agree with. You know, they do, none of it's violent. They just are in possession of items that the state doesn't agree with. Mm-hmm. And they feel like such a threat that they have to suit up, and kick in their door at 4 a.m. I feel like that's asking for more trouble than anything else.
So some of the laws, particularly maybe the drug laws and stuff that, changing drug laws would be a way to get, and we've seen a little bit of that with Prop 47, where the public was really strong support from the public.
I don't know if you saw Dyer saying that he was actively recruiting police that disagreed with Prop 47.
Doesn't surprise me.
I mean, those words actually came out of his mouth. Wow. We're looking for cops that disagree with this idea.
That disagree with the law.
Yeah.
Right.
We're looking for dirty cops.
Right. All right. Okay. Well, I'm going to just, you know, kind of try to wrap it up. What, you know, if people are interested in this issue and want to get involved, what advice would you give to people?
Start filming, you know.
Don't start filming. Learn your rights. Take a second and refresh yourself on your rights, and then start filming. Because when I started, I thought I knew my rights, but I think I was actually probably putting myself in more danger and putting people in the vehicles in danger, you know, for the first few months while I was figuring it out, than I was actually doing any good.
So what specifically did you learn in that initial period that would be helpful to other people?
Well, take a second and evaluate like what you're doing, and then is it so important to go to jail over what you're doing right here than it is to take two steps back. Mm-hmm. You know, just things like that. Mm-hmm. You know, simple, minor things that maybe you don't agree with, like obeying the police every time, but it's mm-hmm. like, is spending the night in jail worth taking two steps or something, you know?
Right.
So,
because you need to be not interfering with whatever the police are doing.
Right? And anybody that knows me knows that I'm a very confrontational, inflammatory individual when it comes to police officers. And so these are like very passive tips that I wasn't doing for a long time, you know, and I got myself in a lot of trouble, and just I started out with a very bad relationship with law enforcement out there, and that in itself can put you in danger.
Well, right. And you think you have been able to change and...
Well, I've been consciously attempting to change my style of, at least when I film the police, you know, maybe not when I'm out actually at a protest or something, but... When in dealing one-on-one with the police or when I'm out just filming the police, I'm definitely trying to keep it more like journalistic, professional than antagonistic or anything like that.
All right. And we're talking to Brian Sumner and Dylan Donnelly about filming the police and other kinds of police accountability activities. So, Dylan, what would be your advice to people?
Well, like Brian said, you know, learn your rights when dealing with the cops, and then empowering others to learn those rights too and use them, because a lot of times it's very regular for police to assume that you don't know your rights and kind of, you know, trample on you and get you to incriminate yourself or get you to step out of your car when you don't need to, or search your car and things such as that. And you could empower yourself, empower your community just by knowing these things.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Brian Sumner and Dylan Donnelly. Thank you very much for sharing your experiences with us. And we're going to take a brief break and come back and talk to Luis Ojeda about the Fresno County Sheriff Mims cooperating with the Immigration Service. Listening to KFCF Fresno 88.1. You're listening to the Street Heat Show, the monthly celebration for workers' rights and social justice. And joining us in the studio, we have Luis Ojeda. Welcome. And Luis is with the California Immigrant Youth Justice Alliance. And you have been out on the street quite a bit recently trying to deal with this disturbing news about what Sheriff Mims is doing. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, definitely. Thank you for having me on. So I think, you know, as most folks have hopefully already heard, a couple weeks ago, Sheriff Mims announced that she was going to be having two ICE agents inside the jail from 6 a.m. to midnight. And essentially, they'd have access to the databases and access to interview rooms for folks that are inside. And essentially, their role is to deport people. So it was very disturbing when we heard it. So we've done several banner drops, press conferences, and then yesterday's rally outside the Fresno County Sheriff's Department, really making sure that she listens to us and that she hears that the community doesn't support this program.
And on the question of her listening to you, you have made attempts to try to talk to her personally?
Yeah, we've tried scheduling several meetings with her. In fact, the latest one, she reached out, someone from her office reached out saying that they couldn't find the meeting request and that they were going to get back to us, and then they never did. So it's been very disappointing trying to get a hold of her.
All right. Okay, so this situation, why don't you give us a little bit of background? Because I know, and I've been involved with, over the years, the whole idea of what of this cooperation between local law enforcement and the immigration and ACLU and others were involved with passing the Trust Act. So tell us about that and how this fits into what's happening now.
Sure. So, I mean, I think the sheriff has always, claimed that her main priority is protecting the community and ensuring that quote-unquote criminals aren't on the streets. So she's always been a really tough sheriff in terms when it comes to immigration and her policies. You know, initially with the Trust Act, following the passage of the Trust Act, which essentially laid out some protections for the undocumented community in order to ensure that they weren't going to be kept extra amount of time and they weren't going to be transferred to ICE. There was some hesitance on behalf of Sheriff Mims to even implement that program. And so I think that was a really disappointing just to see her not come out in support of a policy which we worked so hard to make happen. And then last year with the court case in Oregon that essentially said that it was actually unconstitutional to hold folks extra amount of time and give ICE extra time mm-hmm. to come and pick them up. A lot of counties were moving towards no notification or no hold policies, and instead notifying ICE. So rather than holding people an extra amount of time, they would just notify ICE whenever they were going to get released. And so we saw that the sheriff actually moved towards that policy, whereas they weren't going to hold people an extra amount of time, which we thought again was a step in the right direction. But you know, again, the sheriff seems to be really eager to work with ICE. So then, rather than changing her policies within her department, she just decided to just have ICE inside the jails. So she really took a huge step in the wrong direction. And so now, what we're seeing is this collaboration with ICE that goes beyond anything that we had previously seen in the past.
So it's really not respecting the spirit of the law in terms of ICE.
Right, because I think the point of the Trust Act was to reduce the number of deportations. But when you have ICE in there, who ICE doesn't have to actually obey the Trust Act. And, you know, the sheriff is claiming that they're actually only going after folks that are priority one, priority two. But there's really no way to know if that's true. And I think for the public and for immigrant rights organizations, we don't trust ICE. We don't think that that's an agency that you can actually negotiate with or that you can, try to change their mind about who should be in custody and who shouldn't. And so I think for the sheriff to put a lot of trust in this department, which our community does not trust, really does speak volumes to the kind of policies that she's implementing inside the jail.
A dumb question after what you just said, but what do we know about what happens in Fresno County? What do we know about the deportations here and, you know, who's getting deported?
Well, I mean, I don't think we know much. I think we know what she's claiming, which is that this program has deported 23 people since it started. And again, she claims that these are all people that were in priority one, two. She's mentioned that over, I think, 99% of the people in there are folks that have been convicted with a felony. So I think she's been saying that. But again, we don't know. And so I think part of it is us trying to learn a little bit more about the program. But I think overall, our argument is that ICE doesn't have any place inside the county jail, that we don't feel like local law enforcement should be responsible for implementing or you know, following through with immigration laws. We really feel like it's harmful for the community and in terms of the way that we see the sheriff's department. I think when the community sees the sheriffs, they're associating them with ICE now, because essentially they know that they're collaborating and they're in conversation. And they're clearly, you know, have a very cozy relationship. So I think it's really bad for the department.
How do you think that affects the relationship specifically?
Sure. So I think as a community that is in general afraid of the police, I think any times we make associations with the police, we're already very afraid, you know, given everything that's happened across the country with the killings by the police, all the police abuse that's happening. And we know as people of color, as immigrants, that it's very, very, you're at great risk anytime. You're at great risk at any time that you're, you know, in touch with local law enforcement. And so I think now that the public knows that the sheriff's department is collaborating with ICE, this gives them less reason to trust the police or the sheriffs, because again, there is that cozy relationship that they have.
Do you have any, you know, personal knowledge? I mean, any, you know, friends or people that you have been in contact with, and what their experiences have been? In this regard?
So I think in terms of the program, I couldn't say. Again, this is a very new program, so I don't have any contact with anybody who's actually been taken into custody because of this program. But I think, you know, just overall in terms of the last several years, the amount of deportations that have occurred under the Obama administration, which is over 2 million now, you know, about 400,000 every year, we've seen many of our members who have their family members, whether that's, you know, aunts, uncles, cousins, family members, taken into custody by ICE and then deported. And so I think for us, this is definitely a very personal issue. And I think it also just points to the way that, you know, they've attempted to put people into two separate boxes. There's the people who deserve to be here, and there's the people who deserve to be deported. And I think, you know, as we saw with the DACA and the expansion of DAPA, where we had, you know, folks that the president decided to provide administrative relief to, which is great. But I think what he did at the same time was then criminalize another population within our community, which is, again, people that they claim are criminals, people that they claim are doing these terrible things. But again, not talking about the issue of criminalization of people of color, which is a great portion of the folks that that end up going into ICE custody. You know, the racial profiling that happens by police. Like, how is it that people are actually going into the jails, and how is it that people are actually being transferred? And I think what we see, again, is just this targeted effort by law enforcement and by ICE to do whatever they can, whatever is necessary to go after people. We've heard of raids. We've heard of sharing of records in terms of folks who apply for AB60 licenses and things like that. And so I think overall, I think our community is really in a state of fear. And I think, you know, rather than MIMS trying to address that and trying to improve the relationship, she seems to be doing the opposite and trying to harm that relationship in terms of the trust that we've been trying to restore.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like she's particularly reluctant. I mean, my personal experience is that she's particularly reluctant to have any, you know, dialogue or do town halls or any outreach or any educational kind of work with the Spanish-speaking or the Latino community. Is that what you are seeing? Or are there examples of her going out, I mean, to be fair to her, of her going out and trying to educate people and reach out to them?
Yeah, I mean, I think she feels like she doesn't have to because of the population that has been very supportive. If you look at any article that's been posted online on the news, in terms of the coverage that's occurred around this issue, there's a lot of really negative, very hateful comments. You know, a lot of people who are supporting this program and who are saying that, you know, all illegals should be deported, you know, things like that are just, you know, completely hurtful, completely, you know, xenophobic, racist. So I think part of it is that she feels comfortable in being able to implement this program and that she has that support of a community that really is just racist and really just hates brown people and black people. You know, she doesn't feel like she needs to dialogue with people who are directly impacted by this issue, because she really feels very detached. You know, again, she claims that these are people that are terrible people doing. She keeps throwing out the whole thing about them they could be people who are related to terrorists, which is again ridiculous. I don't think that's the case in terms of who's actually being removed or turned over to ICE. And so again, I think what we're trying to change is that dialogue around how we talk about this. That these are human beings. These are people. These are people that live here in the community. These are people who have families. These are people who have already served their time. And so this idea that that they should be punished after they've already served their time for whatever wrong that they've been accused of is really just hard to process for us, and it really just doesn't make sense.
Well, it's curious to me. I'm fascinated because, I mean, you know, we just got some of the demographic information that, you know, now within the state of California, the Latinos are the largest ethnic or racial or whatever kind of group that you want to call it. And in Fresno County, you know, that's a huge, huge part of our community. And it's just sort of, I'm curious as to why she would feel that, you know, she's an elected official, why she would feel that that's, it's not, you know, worth her while to reach out and communicate.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, even with those statistics, I think it's going to be a few more years or several more years before that plurality actually turns into real power. So I definitely think it's going to be a while before, you know, Latinos can actually be a huge force, particularly here in the Central Valley, where we have a lot of conservative elected officials and conservative people in power. So I think it's still going to be some time before you know, that she can't ignore us. But I think right now she does feel comfortable and she does feel like she can't ignore us. And she can just, you know, she's made these claims that we just run up and down the state doing different things and that we're an open border group. Like, you know, she clearly doesn't take us seriously. And it again, it's like, it's really sad that I think this is, you know, this is an adult, this is somebody who's in a position of power, rather than having an educated conversation about what's going on. Instead, she's just, you know, doing these attacks on us and people in the community who are, again, risking a lot by actually being out there and saying that, no, like, we're undocumented, we're unafraid, you know, we're not going to stand for this, and we're going to do whatever we can to fight the program. So, again, I think her behavior and her her actions have really been shameful.
Of course, I'm going to dive into something here we could talk about for hours, but just a little bit about, you know, the whole situation with the immigration reform. I was just on Facebook, you know, a couple hours ago, and, you know, well, you know, the sort of narrative that you hear about immigrants, that why don't they just do it right? You know, why do they want to do it, you know, illegally? Why don't they just go and, you know, get their papers and just, you know, be responsible about this?
Yeah. So I think it's like this, this misconception that people have that you can just go and fill out a piece of paper and then they'll, you know, let you back into the country and then you're all good and then you can be a good legal immigrant and a good American, which is total, it's a lack of understanding of immigration laws. You know, if you were to actually go back, apply, there'd probably be about a 20-year wait for folks. If you're from Mexico, for example, if you were to go and try to quote-unquote apply the legal way, there'd be about a 20-year wait in order for you to get in that line to then potentially one day actually get status. So I think people, again, don't really understand how that process works. And I think the other component that I think isn't often addressed is this country's foreign policy. In terms of the displacement and the forced migration that occurs in other countries, things like NAFTA that really cause a lot of devastation in Mexico and force people to come here in search of more opportunities, in search of a better life for their family and for their children. And so again, unless people are going to have that conversation and understand that it's a much more complex issue, more than just like, you know, get in line, get your papers and things like that, which again, like, that just really shows that people aren't educated and they're not willing to actually engage in a sophisticated dialogue around this issue.
Okay. We're talking to Luis Ojeda, who is with the California Immigrant Youth Justice Alliance. So we just got a couple minutes left. What can people do if they're concerned about this issue and they would like to get involved and work with your organization?
Sure. So I think, you know, feel free to give me a call. I think we're definitely trying to build power around this through community organizing. We have a petition that's going around. We're collecting signatures that we want to deliver to Sheriff Mims to really, again, let her know that this isn't just, you know, this isn't just Luis Ojeda complaining about this issue, that this is a much bigger effort, and that there's a lot of people who are just unhappy about this policy and that are willing to commit to fighting the program. So I definitely say that, you know, look for us on Facebook. We're the California Immigrant Youth Justice Alliance. Luis Ojeda, you can search for me. Just get in touch, and we can definitely figure out how to support each other.
Okay, great. Anything you would like to add?
No, just let's keep fighting, and eventually one day we will get ICE out of Fresno, ICE out of California, and we'll, you know, be able to recognize the importance of immigrants here in the state and in this country.
Okay, thank you very much. Luis Ojeda from the California Immigrant Youth Justice Alliance. You've been listening to Street Heat. This is KFCF Fresno 88.1. This is Pam Whalen. I'm your host, and Mike Rhodes is on controls. And now we're going to take you back to the KPFA Evening News.
Who use the truth as a shield? There is no bullet that can kill the truth. When you defend it with reason, so let's join together to end this evil madness.